danger arises when the computer gets mixed up with other types of decision making. Our companies are James White and Bill Brown, full Anderson from Berkeley, California. Judy Merrill of New York.
Washington.
Alexandria.
And Robert Silverberg from Brooklyn. I'm Bahini, a sociologist with the Office of International Training, and I'd like to take some of the curse off my opening remark about rational decisions and other sorts. Let me explain that there are, from the sociological point of view, four general types of decision-making, each of them with an appropriate social organization for developing the decision. There's a feedback relationship between the type of decision and the type of organization, that is, a long series of similar problems will tend to develop the appropriate type of social organization in a group. At the same time, the existence of a given type of organization prejudices the group toward the corresponding approach to a problem. Now, the rational decision, in a narrow sense, is the one that's made when our aims are known and the techniques we're going to use for achieving them are known as well. The social organization appropriate to achieving this kind of goal is bureaucracy in the strict sense, in which decisions are made on some kind of consistent and objective basis, and the decision-making authority goes along with formal position in the group, the authority, perhaps I should say. Now, Ken Bulmer from London.
Thanks, London. Tunbridge Road.
Ken Bulmer from Tunbridge Wells, sorry. Not rational in this strict sense are two other types of decision-making, what we might call the judgmental and the technological. With problems that call for judgmental decisions, we don't know which aim should be pursued, although we do have a stock of techniques which would allow us to accomplish our aims once they're decided on. The type of group that seems to achieve goals best when confronted with the need for decisions of this type is a representative, a parliamentary sort of organization, in which conflicts of interest and opinion can be resolved or reconciled, in which the individual's status is informal and is clear on the basis of his past decisions. Technological decision-making, now, is the sort we usually need in science and the arts. But as we know well enough what aims we want to achieve, and the necessary decision is what techniques will allow us to achieve them. When groups have to deal with problems like this, the best results seem to come from a collegium type of organization, a group of equals, that is, whose status changes, again informally, on a case-by-case basis according to the sort of expertise the group happens to need. Outside these three falls a sort of decision-making that's sort of inverted rationality, where we find people addressing problems of such a nature that they not only have no idea what their aim should be, but don't know what techniques to follow in achieving any aims they do happen to decide on. This is the sort of thing you find in obsessing religion and the sterile fringe of the avant-garde, or as I'd say if I were trying to be nasty, pseudoscience and pseudo-art. The most satisfactory group here, meaning about the only kind that can exist without the member going crackers, is the discipleship, the little in-group of acolytes following a charismatic leader who pronounces authoritatively on all issues by reason of his divine grace. I have to shun any instances here, but I suspect you can all think of some names. Now, the conventional computer bogey is the monster which itself takes over the world. Science fictional theme 37.2 sub A, I believe. But after all, any system can cause trouble when it goes aglay. Forgive my dropping into dialect. There are several ways that the automation of decision making can cause trouble even if it goes right. For one thing, by a sort of inverse Parkinson's law, work tends to wind up being dealt with by the most powerful tools. The fact of automation makes bureaucracy enormously efficient will, all by itself, attract into the bureaucratic system many problems which properly should be handled by a judgmental or technological type of group. For another, remember that all these group forms and organizational activities have feedback. They interact upon each other. Now, a hierarchical authoritarian democracy does have a number of virtues, but the democratic qualities that go with, say, the judgmental parliament or the technological collegium are not among its good features. Centralized authoritarianism has strong survival potential, as witness the Roman Catholic Church, Los Angeles Phantom, and other analogous groups. But making people accustomed to it will at the same time disqualify them for the democratic systems. Now, I think I have annoyed my fellow panelists enough to overcome the fact that it's 10 o'clock Sunday morning, and I'll call on James White to open fire first.
There is perhaps we're not so much afraid of the robots taking over the world. We just wish they wouldn't be so damn smug while they're doing it. Conceivably, someone on the panel might like to consider, in the first place, to what extent the emotional attitude this engenders might in turn influence the very use to which computers are put. And in the second place, perhaps how far we ought to carry the automation, not only of routine jobs that really aren't fit for a human being, not only of jobs that human beings couldn't possibly do under any circumstances. How far ought we to carry the automation of our entire society and our entire lives? Is it necessarily bad to carry it as far as it will go? I mean, dismiss your prejudices and imagine a world in which the robots have, let us say, taken over and needed anymore as far as the operations of the world go. Is this necessarily a bad world, even from the human standpoint? Perhaps men will then find something better to do. I don't know if this has anything whatsoever to do with what Jakini had in mind, but at least it might get us off the ground.
Actually, Paul, I think men could find, very easily find, something better to do than working for a living. Jody, have you had any run-ins with the fiendish automatons?
Well,
Washington is a hotbed of them, you know.
The only thing I can really contribute right at this moment is that were there a robot in my particular executive suite, it would be able to speak on a panel before it had finished its first cup of coffee. So I think perhaps we should turn it over to Bob at the moment.
Well, I think a round of congratulations are in order. Congratulations to Judy for the deft way in which she dumped a hot cup of coffee in my lap just now. Congratulations to Dick for his masterly synthesis of an exceedingly taxing, profound problem. Congratulations to my friend James over there for his skillful parrying of a vicious opening thrust. Muffled congratulations to Poole for his deplorable attempt to get the panel into a state of relevancy. And my most heartfelt appreciation for Ken Bomer here, who has cagely managed to stay out of this entire thing so far.
Amazing, man. How are you going to
drive him? I think we have a theme that is pregnant with frothiness and deserves...
Hey, I've got something for you, Bob. You know about this IBM machine in Florida that's writing love poems?
No.
Well, there is one.
Yes.
That's all.
Writing love poems to whom, Judy?
Probably that machine.
To any machine. I think it's interesting, though, that the one panelist who is alert enough or evil enough to cling to the theme was our friend Poole over there with his extensive scientific orientation. And he opened his discussion of robotics with a story that was basically hostile, quickly justifying it by saying it's only a story and that many scientific people are hostile. Of course, Poole must be hostile since he selected that story. The revealing thing about any person's conversation or writing is what he selects to say out of the infinity of things to say. So clearly, even Poole Anderson, who has wrestled with Newton and thrown him for a fall, is uneasy in his innards about robots. This is very troublesome to people like me. I really have had only the most second-hand of connection with robots and computers. I've seen a few. my wife talk about them, and I nodded thoughtfully. I've read the articles in Astounding over the last 15 years. I don't know what the damn things are up to, and I'm afraid of them, but I'm just a clod. Poole is a scientific man. My wife is a scientific woman. And they both have this nervous attitude, which Poole revealed so blatantly in his selection of anecdotes. The attitude of a trapped panelist at 10 on a Sunday morning. I'd like to know, Poole, you notice, Ken, how well I've kept you out of it. I'd like to know why you are in the Ray Bradbury camp.
When you call me that, smile. No, actually, far from it. I believe I mentioned or spoke of the automation of jobs which are not fit for human beings to do, like working on an assembly line, going through the same motion hour after hour, day after day. Garbage collection, working with dangerous chemicals, with radioactivity, or even, God help us, handling a subscription department. And now I will tell my other subscription department story, because this may give the panelists time for about another 2-minute nap. this one is perhaps a bit apocryphal, although I have heard it as allegedly true, that a man from IBM went through the enormous plant of the Time Life building in New York, you know, Time, Life, Fortune, the Henry Luce Empire, and he saw a room full of girls who were sending out subscription renewal notices. There go those subscription renewals again. And there were quite a few girls there, and between what they were paid and their office space they occupied and incidentals and so on, it was costing Henry Luce $1 million a year just to have notices sent to people, dear sir, your subscription is due to expire, please renew. Or we hope you will renew, or whatever it said. IBM man explained that he could install a machine which would do every bit of this. It would keep track of these subscriptions. It would note when they were, when each one was due to shortly going to expire. It would mail out a renewal notice. If no renewal came in, it would mail out a second or a third notice up to a certain limit. It would address and stamp, that is, postage meter, all these letters themselves. Untouched, the whole operation untouched by human hands. And of course it would record the subscriptions that were renewed. Well, Henry Luce had nothing against saving $1 million a year, so he had IBM install the machine for him. And it all worked very fine until one hot summer day, and as Bob Silverberg knows to his very well to his sorrow, New York heat in summer has to be endured to be relieved. And, then, you know, with a humidity of something like 95% as well. And some, conceivably because of that, a couple of relays stuck together in this machine, and without anyone's noticing, it mailed out 5,000 subscription renewal notices to the same person. It so happened the same person was a bachelor sheep herder living way out in a lonely little cabin in Montana. When all this mail arrived from him, the local post office had to hire a truck from some farmer to carry it all out to his cottage. He was out on the range at that time. When he came home, he found his poor little shack just about buried under notices saying, "Dear sir, your subscription to Type is about to expire. Don't you wish to renew?" Well, he plowed his way through these 5,000 envelopes, made up a check for his subscription renewal, sent it personally to Henry Luce with the single note enclosed, "You win." Now, this, it's really not relevant to anything particular. However, Bob did ask me why this hostility, and I said no particular hostility, rather welcoming these machines in their proper place, and not even feeling that we can set any limit on what the proper place is. Perhaps it is desirable, let us say. Perhaps it would be a tremendous broadening of the humanness. If his very body and brain become a couple to machines of one sort or another. I don't know. I'm just saying it's revolutionary. Let's not knock the underpinnings out from society overnight. Let's not rush into things that may have completely revolutionary characteristics that may cause unforeseeable and highly undesirable changes in society. An awful lot of very brilliant thinking is going into the design of these machines. Some of that thinking, or thinking of a similar quality, should be turned on the problem of how to use them, what for, and especially the problem of dealing with the consequences, whether good or ill, of our using them, because they certainly have the potentiality of creating a state of human existence such as the planet has never seen before. And they probably are going to do so. I would just like it to be a desirable state.
Paul, I think your warning comes too late. I told Dick yesterday when he tried to approach me seriously about this topic that if I came up and sat here long enough for a chance to wake up in the morning, I would inevitably have a great deal to say. And I thought it would be some stimulating remark one of you made that would start this off, but it turned out to be something else entirely. Apparently this hotel, realizing that they had a science fiction convention going on, made some revisions in their usual menus and preparations. I just noticed my check here from the coffee shop last night, and it says, as you go down the list of things that are available in the coffee shop, there's an item that says soup, and one that says food, one that says pastries and dessert, beverages, wines, and then there's the last one at the bottom, which is minerals. Now, this suggests to me that someone has been looking around at the science fiction magazines and has decided that in one case or another, a robot has already taken over. Being an ardent reader of all the magazines and sort of over-involved myself, would hesitate to make any guesses about which one this might be. But it does suggest an interesting line of conversation. Which magazine might it be, or is it all of them? And how do you go about editing science fiction if you happen to be a robot? And there are a lot of things involved here. First of all, you've got manuscripts to read now. I don't care which of you wants to discuss this. I will only toss out one little suggestion about how to determine whether a manuscript is acceptable, based on the first time I ever heard of a writer's conference, concerning which I was told how they taught style, prose style. This involves counting the adjectives, counting the verbs, and if there were more adjectives than verbs, it was unacceptable. Now this, you know, suggests a whole range of approaches by which a robot could determine whether or not stories should be published. If there are, for instance, more robots than people in the story, or if there are more antennae than eyes, or something like this, and you know, go up and down the line. But this is the least of the editorial functions. You come into delicate problems like the writer ego and how to cope with it. You come into things like the care and feeding of writers, the expense account syndrome. You come into things like attending a science fiction convention. How do you get a robot to a science fiction convention? What size robot do you have? Can you transistorize it? How do you get it, for instance, to determine which hotel room to get to at what time of night? And what does it drink? I'm just trying to be helpful. Someone here might like to carry on. Jim, you look right.
Actually, I thought that editors were using Fortazel twigs these days. Well, why you haven't put in your 6 months' worth yet?
Tenon. Can you all hear me?
Good.
Well, wake up. We're going to talk now. I prepared an on-screen particular thing. It was very impressive. It was very detailed and highly inflammatory. All about robots in the executive suite. However, as the executive suite hasn't been touched on, I'll forget that and we'll start fresh. I did have a newspaper cutting I'll read later on. It's very interesting. But I'd like to start at this problem from the other end. You see, when we discussed this panel, we all decided to talk about anything we like to talk about. These people have let me down. They've been talking about robots. On the other hand, this is very poor. However, talking about robots, we'll start from the other end. Now, what is the point of human existence? Now, you could say experience. To experience pleasurable things, and if you're a masochist, to unpleasurable things, which is pleasurable to you, so that all works out in the end for the same. Now, you can drink a cup of tea and thoroughly enjoy it. That is an experience. Or you can drink a cup of coffee and say, eck. That's another experience. You put the two together. You can come to a convention. It's wonderful, marvelous. That's an experience. Now, life is made up of experiences. And presumably, one is enough. Once you've experienced... One experience of any individual thing. For instance, you can go surfing. You master the art. You do a perfect surf run. You can never better. That's an experience. Now, however many times you carry on doing it, you'll never get back to that peak of perfection. So, we come back a few million years from this, back a bit. Now, having obtained all of these peaks of perfection, the best convention you ever went to, the best cup of tea you ever drank, the best surf ride you ever went on, the best film you ever saw, that's slightly different. You take the essences of all these peaks of perfection and distill them down to a tape, which is through a tape machine. And then like Lawrence Manning and all these other people you know about, you lie on your bed and you plug in the automation and the robot and you experience all these wonderful things. Now, and the rest of life, the city around you, the world, all your bodily needs and functions are taken care of by these robots that these people hate. Now, a robot is a slave, and everybody speaks up for slaves, but these robots are slaves and they hate them. So they're dirty racists, you see. No?
Many of us are Americans, and...
Well, you're not.
And it's a well-known what Americans are like. So it's understandable that we're...
We don't repeat that.
I'm sorry, that was last night.
Let me finish, then you can show me your pieces. Right, so having done all this, you see, you now have everybody in the world lying on their beds with these machines on, and the robots taking care of them. And in time...
Lovely sound.
Huh?
Lovely sound.
Yeah.
Now, can we go back to bed now?
Yeah, you can switch on your robots. Now, this is one way of looking at life. This is one end product of robots. And all this gibbering about circulation and that story you know about this one. There's a machine, a proper scientific job, which can, by adding up the way in which material has been written, tell you who wrote it. You know about that one. The Bible is now being subjected to intensive analysis to find out Who wrote what?
And he never did at all.
So this is
a... Wasn't it Bob Tucker?
Anyway, I was hoping enough. But my point is very simple, that robots are here as people and things to help us, and we should master them and tell them what to do, and they'll do it, and we'll have a better and fuller life. And I expect one fuller and better life, which is carried to a ludicrous extreme, but if you're frightened of a robot, then you're going to be done down. They're just things to help us, and you tell them what to do, and they'll do it. And if they start getting uppity, what do? You send for rain or something, but you engineer into this thing commands that prevent them from giving you fear.
If I understand your point correctly, I will just footnote the business you mentioned, the rather horrible vision you mentioned of just having all your pleasure fed directly into your brain not bothering with experience. I've seen it. To be sure, it was only a rat with one of these electrodes in his skull, visibly pressing the pedal to stimulate himself, but it was a rather horrible sight.
I wonder if you could do that with the operating button on a mimeograph.
I will add, though, without trying to be Luddite about it, that the same technique of direct pleasure stimulation, in the first place, is teaching us a great deal about brain physiology and the nervous system, psychology even, and surely it is always good to acquire new knowledge. And in the second place, it's even found some humanitarian use, jolt of electrical stimulation to the brain helps terminal cancer patients and such like people. Takes away the pain for a while. Of course, we're all agreed that man should remain man, whatever that means, and not become just a
chauvinist.
Just another cog in a vast machine, or even altogether by machines. The problem we face, perhaps, is if we want to stay in control of the situation, we human beings. We don't have to fear the machines themselves. They're things that we make, and as you say, we can engineer the specifications we want into them. But how about our fellow man over in the next country, our competitor, especially in the game of international politics, deciding he can get ahead by organizing his country just one step more efficiently? Naturally, that implies mechanizing it that one step more, reducing the amount of decision making done by sloppy, inefficient humans. So, of course, you yourself have to respond in kind, and there you go. I don't say this is necessarily any automatic road to the apocalypse, only that. This sort of thing might very well reinforce the trend. In other words, the whole thing I'm trying to get at is that the problem is not the robots themselves. I mean, they're only tools, and sometimes extremely good tools. It's man, as always. The robots aren't going to make us useless or make us into some chrome-plated version of themselves. If that happens, it will be something that man will have done to himself. And perhaps, as I was saying earlier, we should
begin right now to foresee the possibility of doing that sort of thing to ourselves without trying to abolish the robots, without even stopping to make new and better ones, different kinds of ones. We should perhaps be a little more careful, a little more forethoughtful about what departments of life we introduce them into.
Well, I think it might be useful to isolate the area of fear, which is a very easy thing to do. We just have to go to the most hackneyed of science fiction stories to find it. What we are afraid of in robots is not a quantitative revolution, but a qualitative one. We've had an automation revolution going on for something like 250 years now. It's going on a little faster at the moment. But what is happening today began in the 18th century with the cotton gin and things like that. So it is not a fear of robots putting street sweepers out of employment that is really serious. This is something we've lived with since Eli Whitney and since steam engine. The robots that we have today are hostile making because they're awe-inspiring. They do things so fast and so well. But most of them are really just big adding machines and things like that. We program them, we plug them in. We can be envious of them a bit because their brains are not as fogged with morning dew as ours. But yet, they're under our thumbs. The point at which we begin worrying, in which the real hostility comes in, is your berserk robot of your berserk computer. Let's distinguish between computers and robots anyway. A robot is something big and clanking that walks around and brings you breakfast. Computer.
I really don't think these actually very nice ladies in room service would appreciate that.
Well, actually, the computers here are quite inefficient. Judy read us the bill from the coffee shop with minerals down at the bottom as one of the categories. And yesterday for lunch, I definitely ordered food. And I got a tray of minerals. This wouldn't have happened if things were programmed properly. What we're afraid of, really, is the computing machine that begins to program itself, which is a generation we have not yet reached, and which perhaps we don't reach for a while, where the control itself leaves our hands, and we can no longer pull the plug. We no longer are feeding in the commands, and then we're in a disturbing situation.
Well, such a thing is certainly coming, and it will, I predict, quite certainly be built such that you can pull. There will be a plug that can be pulled on the damn thing, and if it gets above itself, the plug will be pulled, or even if it's made without a plug, you don't have to read its silly printout, do you? You don't have to listen to it. The thing is, the problem is that machines like this are not going to go berserk. They're going to give very sound, good advice. They're going to show you the optimum way to achieve just about any goal you set out to achieve, and you'd be a fool not to follow their advice. Of course, since the robot almost in the nature of the case is programmed to show you the optimum way to reach one goal, we might over-organize for that, losing too many other values in the process. Or to some extent, as you say, this has been happening ever since the 18th century. I would certainly not want to go back to a pre-industrial era, but the fact of the matter is that we have virtually no more clothing, furniture, and so on with any of the sacrifice that for the sake of the admitted benefits that mass production will bring. For the admitted benefits of the coming age of the computer, we shall have to sacrifice other values. You don't get anything for nothing. And I wonder if we might not be in some danger of giving up too much, of selling some kind of birthright for what will, after all, while very good pottage, still be only a mess of pottage.
I'm going to pick up on that, Tom. Everybody here has been concerned with robots getting uppity, and I continue to be obsessed with this business of getting up, which is more of a problem. And I want to point out that this is quite serious. You take this curtain, the edge of the platform, and it divides, at the moment, the executive suite here, which is obviously, you see, this well-functioning, well-oiled operation. Now, you take the people who are up here, who all could have been replaced, presumably, might have been replaced with a robot to operate this here now executive suite. And then you take all the people out there, who are the human beings who have to operate with this robot in the executive suite. Now, suppose you had put this operation into the hands of a completely rational machine, whose values were purely logic and reason and so forth. There wouldn't have been a panel this morning. The question is, why are all those people out there, up and out of bed? And would the robot have been able to anticipate that? Now, I'm making this like a joke, but it's not.
Oh, well, a robot computer, whatever you want to call it, perhaps we should be a little more precise in our terminology. For example, at what point does a computer truly start to think?
Shall we first ask at what point a person starts to think? And then
when you find out, tell me. I'd like to try it sometime.
Shortly after lunch, with most of us.
At least after the first beer.
What does the robot use in place of my coffee? Your view.
Well, now, let me just make this one more or less serious point. At present, there are problems which no computer can solve, and it's not that we haven't built the computers big enough or given them enough time or something. There are problems which it is inherently and absolutely impossible for computers to solve. These are mathematical, logical type problems. The proof of my statement goes back to Gödel's theorem, and what it amounts to essentially is that within any given frame of postulates, logic, what have you, there will always be found certain questions which cannot be answered within by the use of that system alone. You have to establish a broader system of postulates. In a word, you have to have creativity. Any tool or any computer can now work out, let's say, the trajectory of a shell fired from a gun by the use of Newton's laws of motion and gravitation, but you needed a Newton there in the first place to formulate them. So, somewhere along the line, however, a computer will come up that has creativity, that actually can think. I see no inherent reason why this should not happen.
But can it think adequately irrationally in order to handle the problems of human beings who are going to do things like getting up on Sunday morning?
I don't know about that. It might be a very, by human standpoint, say, very cold sort of creativity. but in that case, you might say, here's If it were a human being, you'd say here's somebody who has a magnificent intellect and no personality whatsoever. This may not even be the case. For that matter, if you make a robot conscious, perhaps automatically you give it emotions. What are human emotions anyway? I don't know. I don't think anybody does. What causes a state of feeling? Well, I know very well what causes the emotion you feel when there's a panel at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. Getting into more subtle things, love, hate, the sheer wish to do something or not to do something, where does that come from? I think if we treat him right, the coming computer, the coming robot and so on will be a very good friend and very good companion to us. It is the problem of treating him right, not trying to make ourselves into poor imitations of him.
I still think it's more of a problem than that. Reduce my former division a little farther. You can take Dickie, who is the executive suite in this case. The rest of us, let's say, are merely factors being manipulated. Boy, were we. Now, yesterday, Dick came up to me, or the day before, or some peculiar time in this case, I think, too, and said, what are you going to talk about? And as I already reported, I wound up saying, look, Dick, once everybody starts talking, I'll start shooting my mouth off. Don't worry. This is reliable. Now, suppose I had said this to a properly functioning robot. It wouldn't have believed me.
Why not?
It might have believed me. Let's say it would have believed me. But then it went to Jim White. And he said, I'm no good on panels. I won't have anything to say. I heard him say this. And I don't know what Paul answered when he was approached, but I can guess. I don't know what Bob answered or what you did, Ken.
Well, I was very rude about
that. Exactly. Now, any properly functioning robot, after speaking to all five of us, would have said, all right, I have here, someone who doesn't believe there will be an audience. Here's a factor. This is a human being assessing human beings. There will be no audience, perhaps. I have here someone who says he's incapable of speech. I have here someone whose only speech seems to be yike. I don't know what you said. Well, I'm sure it was nothing encouraging.
No.
And I wound up saying, I will speak after the others have spoken. Therefore, this properly functioning robot would have said, A, there are no speakers. B, there will perhaps be no audience. C, we will cancel the whole thing. Now, look, here are all of you who for some insane reason are not listening to us. Here are all of us who for slightly less insane reasons, because we have this no place, so please, bro, managed to haul ourselves out of bed and get up here in spite of the fact that we had a subject we couldn't begin to think about and that we had already informed the chairman that we had nothing to say about it. And here we are talking about it. Now, would a robot have expected this, or would you all have gotten out of your beds, blundered your way down to the lobby, and found a big notice out there, program canceled due to lack of interest?
Judy, it would have happened just this way. With a properly functioning robot, the robot being a big added machine would work on a statistical basis, would work on past experience and samples of probabilities.
From other conventions,
yes. The robot would be in possession of all sorts of data that would help it to shape its decisions around the various inchoate things that we might have mumbled at it. It would know, for example, that even at 10 in the morning, when you take four science fiction writers and put them on a platform, however leery they may seem, they will find something, however irrelevant, to say.
And
are there five science fiction writers on the platform? Five sides. There should have been seven. I read it in the program. But anyway, the computer would know on basis of that past experience that a synergistic, early in the morning, chemical reaction would take place, which would produce words. And so the panel would have something to say when it finally got here. The computer would also have data on audiences, and it would know that out of 300 convention attendees, 20 of them will be down here at 10 in the morning because that's the kind of people they are. 30 of them will be down here because they simply haven't gotten to bed and they decide there's no point in doing it. 20 more will be here out of a morbid curiosity to see us make fools of ourselves. Already we have an audience of 70, which is adequate for a panel of 5. Now, you will not be getting an optimum audience.
14 to 1 is pretty good.
You won't be getting the optimum panel audience because it will, after all, be composed of convention goers at 10 in the morning who are functioning no better than panelists at 10 in the morning. You will not get an optimum panel. You will not get an optimum panel because we're sicklied over with the pale cast of last night. But you will get a panel. You see, the functioning of society will go on, however clumsily, under the guidance of this robot.
This your cause society?
Well, this is a microcosm of society. Somewhat rusty microcosm. So I think that a properly functioning robot, and of course you put us right into the realm of tautology there by qualifying it in such a neat way, a properly functioning robot is, by definition, one that functions properly. We'll get us all down here for the panel as we are, but it'll also serve minerals. No.
They've all been talking about the very near future, about the problems inherent in introducing robots into our society, but I think science fiction writers today, although these are the immediate and pressing impacts that are working on us now, are also interested in what will happen when we have robots accepted into our society. I think this particular angle of it, I did mention one rather silly extreme, but it's worth considering. Judy's mentioned this very interesting point, and here's we've got to it. Here she's taken the concept of a robot actually operating, accepted. We naturally assume this robot will run the convention for us. But how will the robots run other things besides conventions? Just to show marital choice. Are we allowed to be married in the future by eugenics? And I can't read that. This looks like the blast off the Gemini. if we all get married by robot, if we have children by robot, and if
there are some things the human race will ever stand for having already.
Well, I don't know. Bulls do, animals do, and they're unlucky you can.
They're controversial. They haven't any members of Parliament.
Well, aren't we talking about whether we're going to be controversial?
Well, that's it. I don't think we are. But one point that Paul made, he said we'll always be men. Now, this is a fine and wonderful thought, but of course it isn't true.
I didn't say we will always be men, or if I did, I didn't mean to. I said I hope we would always be men in the sense of being something recognizably human, but I'm aware of the possibility of a certain degree of dehumanization setting in along the lines you were just now discussing.
I want to point out that a robot is running this thing. It had just begun to warm up. You know, people are beginning to think of things to say, and this man over here, if indeed it is a man, he's passing around this little thing on which he wrote, -3 minutes, -2 minutes, and -1 minute. We all want to talk about it, and we're not going to have any more time. Therefore, I am grabbing this last minute to say, short time ago, you mentioned this Washington bit. Well, there was a piece in the paper a little while ago by Russell Baker. This is an American paper, you understand. But Russell Baker is a pretty good writer anyhow. And this was all about Washington and about what happens in Washington bureaus. And the point he was making, which I found very upsetting, was that he had found increasingly a certain thing he called machine envy on the part of the people who were working in the Washington bureaus. And he explained how all these clerks and bureaucratic employees were busily trying to become machines. And I mean, all you have to do is mention this, and you've all had the experience. You walked in somewhere where someone looked at you, you know, with this flat face and said, fill out the form. And you say, yes, but what I want to find out is which, fill out the form. This sort of thing. And then he carried this on to just a suggestion of what happens when the machines get people envy. And
I'd
humanized as Judy would have you believe. The problem is that we do have to stick to a closing schedule here because...
Just what a robot would say.
Right. It's rational because we're going to have to change this hall over for the banquet. However, in the interest of scientific completeness, I'd like to finish that story that Cole started about the Montana sheep herder who got 5,000 demands for a renewal of the subscription to Life magazine. It seems he took the extras round back and back inside his outhouse, and I submit to you that that is a computer story with a happy ending.